Harihi Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahana Vyankara Bhavahai Tejasvina Vahitamastu Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shiva Sadigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Top of 19. Literally, so they say, it is ascertained in this way. When an eldest person tells the next in age, bring the cow, a young boy may notice that second person proceeding to bring a cow. The boy may thus understand from the first person's words the idea of bringing an object with a dewlap and other features. And later, when the boy hears other statements like, graze the cow and bring the horse, by inclusion and exclusion, he discerns the conventions that the word cow means that which has a dewlap, and that bringing means fetching. Siddhanta Dharpana 2.7. Thus, since a person from the very beginning acts only in response to words that, as combined with other words in a sentence, connect to something that needs to be done, only in such a connection is the literal meaning of words recognized, and should the purport of statements be found. Right, this is in connection with
refutation of
karma mimamsa. Okay. Okay. Here, although we have thus established that all the statements of the Vedas are authoritative, some persons might say that the authority of the Vedas is limited to matters of prescribed duties, not those of settled fact, because one can determine the literal meaning and purport of statements only in activity that needs to be done. Right? So, the objection raised here represents the opinion of a particular group within Jaimini's Mimamsa school, the school that puts forward a ritualistic interpretation of the Vedas. Right? So, it's saying here it's even just a particular group within Jaimini, so it's not even attributing to Jaimini. Jaimini's made this point, but somehow or another there's a group that is applying it in this way only.
Yes.
Right? The school puts forth a ritualistic interpretation of the Vedas. According to the general view of Mimamsa, our dharma, the purpose for which human beings exist, is to perform the duties prescribed for us in the Vedas. And the purport of the Vedas is to prescribe those duties. Anything else the Vedas say is merely of secondary significance. One of Jaimini Sutra states, Amnayasya kritar tavad anartakyam atad artanam tasmad anityam uchate. So, because the revealed scriptures exist for the sake of activity, whatever they say that does not serve that end is not actually useful, and so is said to be non-eternal. Purvimimamsa Sutras 1.2.1. Sabar, in his commentary on the sutra, cites examples of such non-essential Vedic statements, such as so rodid yad arodid tad rudasya rudatvam. Agni cried, and because he cried, he is called Rudra. Taittiriya Samhita 1.5.1.1. Although this statement gives us information about how Agni came to also be called Rudra, it does not tell us what duties we should perform. In response to the suggestion that these duties should be inferred from the statement's context, Sabara asked what duty we could infer. That because Agni cried, everyone else should also cry. That makes little sense. Therefore, such non-essential statements, even though found in the Vedas, do not have full Vedic authority. Sabara explains how it is that Jaimini calls them non-eternal. even though they are part of the eternal Vedas. Yadyapi cha nityani tatapi na nityam artam kurvanti ti. Although these, like the other statements, are of course eternal, they do not fulfill any eternal purpose. Savara Bhatsha 1:1. So he is still maintaining the point that the Vedas are eternal. But their point is that if it doesn't say a prescribed duty to do, you don't worry about it. Right? Yeah. Difficulty is since they're only focusing on prescribed duties, they're only going to look for these external physical duties. So they're not going to actually count things like prescribed duties like developing love of God and stuff like that. Otherwise, why would they stay within the realm of karma and monks? Yes.
Now, who's going to determine what's talking about the prescribed duties?
I think it just means like this. It gives this example that you can't figure out what you should do from this. So therefore,
It means you yourself have to.
Yeah. Means. So it means that, in other words, it's not something that you should be doing, therefore you don't worry about it. Yeah, basically. But the thing is, it's not like it's saying something and you know, like go wash the dishes, and it's kind of like, you know, what does that mean? So therefore you leave it, you know, like that. It's
that's the risk.
Yeah. The whole difficulty is that if the Veda is eternal, why would it have these things in there unless there's something more?
It seems right? Very whimsical too.
Yeah, well, that's why it's less. But the thing is it's you know, well developed, so it therefore can deal with all these other schools. So you can understand also, even though when we're dealing how technical all these schools are, that. They're not so really developed in their final conclusion. That's the weakness. Though very intellectual, that's the thing, is that if it's so intellectual, then people automatically take it that it's something, you know, good. You know, just like anything, the modern academy, if it's there, you know, then it's so developed in a certain area, but at the same time as its conclusions or, you know, practical, is not very well developed, you know. So then, but it's accepted as intellectual. I remember when it was. I don't remember if it was 70s or 80s. It must have been. Maybe it was 70s. They went to this. It was this guy. He means all the buses that you see. The bodies of those buses are built at this guy's factory. He builds them all. Huge factory in Bihar. So I remember visiting his house. So then, he had this whole library of Aurobindo. And he was, at some point, I don't know how it came up, but he just said, it's Aurobindo, you know, it's so, you know, spiritual, because what he says, you just can't understand. You know? So therefore, it must be spiritual. You know? So like that, people have their definitions. Because he's a super intelligent guy, practically, materially, so therefore, he would there consider himself, you know, an authority in this case, because he would... when I say all the buses, I don't mean some of them. I mean all of them. You know, this guy's doing well. But he would attend his office 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon. But in that 20 minutes, he would do a lot of work. I mean, literally talking on two phones at once and that. As soon as he walked in, everything happened. Get this one, get that one, get this one, all these different things. Where's his paper? That he's signing. It's insane. It's like right out of some kind of, you know, Fellini movie or something. It's so bizarre. But at the same time, he'll go like that, because I came in to talk to him. I came in, you know, he sat me down. He started doing this whole thing. He's so insanely busy. I said, okay, I'll come back in the afternoon.
You know, he comes, you know, came at 10, you know, come back at 4 or something. So then he said, okay. So I came back at 4, exactly the same thing. So I didn't know what to do, so I just sat there. And he's doing like that insanely for 20 minutes. And then after 20 minutes, he just, everything stops, all the phones, everything. And he just sits back, leans back in his chair, yes, may I help you? So, in other words, he wasn't just, you know, your common average businessman who is not intelligent. And so for him, it's so technical that you can't understand, right? So that's basically how it goes. So, you know, use fancy words, say it in some ways that nobody can understand, and then it must be fancy. Therefore, Prabhupada says it very simply, so therefore it can't be too intellectual. Right? But the point is they still don't understand what to do. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Words in a sentence each have their individual meanings, but the meaning of a sentence is more than simply the sum of all such meanings. So this is, that's Jiva Goswami, or that's still Savarna, or Jaimini, or...
He's quoting Shabra, I believe.
Okay.
Or, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Prabhakara, the founder of one of the two main branches of the Mimamsa school, takes this to imply that each word expresses its meaning only when combined with the other words in the sentence. And also contributing to the meaning of a sentence is the tatparya, the intention of the speaker. The statement, bring the saindava, for example, is ambiguous because the word saindava can mean either salt or a horse from the Sindh province.
Don't use that one at dinner. Don't use that word at dinner.
Might end up with a horse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, definitely don't use it down at the races either. But from the context of this sentence, we should be able to know which of the two meanings the speaker intended.
Otherwise, you'll put $100 on the table salt.
Yeah, well, that's what. And the sign of it in the pepper is falling close behind. The some persons Sri Jiva mentioned here are actually one faction of Prabhakara's followers, who incorporated into their general theory of word meaning the idea of the primary importance of Vedic injunctions. According to them, words used in sentences all refer, directly or otherwise, to man's dharma, the duties he should perform. Evidence of this, they say, can be seen in the way a child learns a language. The child first understands commands by seeing the actions they inspire. Only later does the child begin to distinguish the individual meanings of words. Furthermore, even though in daily life we often use words without reference to anything that must be done, even those words we learn first from commands. This Purvapaksha, the objection to be answered, and the following reply by a contending group of Prabhakara's followers have been adapted by Sri Jiva Goswami from Gangesh Upadhyaya's Tattva Chintamani, the principal textbook of the Nyaya, Navanyaya school. Okay, so this is Jiva Goswami. Okay. The response to this lies in the question, why should an account of settled fact lack denotative power? Is it because in a settled fact there is no activity to enable us to grasp the connection between words and what they denote? Or is it because a so-called settled fact is also connected with something that needs to be done? It can't be the first, since we see that statements like, a son has been born to you, create a radiant face in the father, and other effects in the hearers of similar statements. Nor can it be the second, because in such ideas as the birth of a son, there's no link to something that needs to be done. In the second case, we should not presume something that needs to be done, such as, look at him, because there are no grounds for this presumption. One might suggest that the ground for such a presumption is that without it, one could not have a first recognition of the meaning of the words, a meaning which should have been linked to something needed to be done. But no, the reason given, that the capacity for meaning is found only in words that are connected, through other words, to a statement, to an enjoined action, is not even valid, since it fails to be true of the very word that expresses action.
This word is not connected through other words with something that needs to be done. Moreover, were a relationship of meaning to be known, as proposed, simply from a statement's connection with suitable external idea, the words modifying the statement's verb would become useless. Nor should it even be suggested that something that needs to be done can have a connection with something else that needs to be done, since there is no reason for linking one with the other, and indeed an endless regression would result. Nor is it a hard and fast rule that a meaning first learned must be connected with something that needs to be done. We see that a child may come to a proper understanding, even in a matter-of-fact statement, when he is told, this is a piece of cloth. Siddhanta... No, it's not Siddhanta Kaumudi. Sarvasamvada. Yes, 42.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't want to go into more contemporary meetings.
No. I know a person who was named Soren Sorensen. He got his initials tattooed on his shoulder, and then he figured out, wait a minute, that's not good.
Not good. Not good. Unless, of course, he was 6'4", blonde, and blue-eyed. Right? Then it would have been okay.
He was not.
He was not. In the exchange of objections and replies between the two parties of Prabhakar and Mimamsakas, the proponents of the second view, the statements need not always relate to something needing action. Ask their opponents what a declarative sentence lacks that prevents it from expressing a direct meaning. After posing this question, they themselves offer two possible replies. One is that mere statements of fact do not elicit active responses that enable observers to learn the meanings of the words used. The other is that there's no such thing as a mere statement of fact at all, because every statement has some connection with an action that needs to be done. Both replies are invalid. Right, so, you caught all this, right?
No, I was going to ask you a question. I was going to ask you if it's possible, could you give a summary for the less intelligent? Because I just...
I'm trying to find something to grab onto here, because it basically seems that you have a bunch of, super intelligent but slightly misguided people that they're arguing over all these different things, you know, basically. See, is that they have to create something because all they have means the Veda for them is just something that's telling them what to do, and you do that and it's pious. So therefore... since it's going to be something fruitive, that means there can be no other meanings. So if it doesn't tell you something to do, then it has no importance for them. That's the weakness here. So then they overly get involved in words. Now you do have the point, as was pointed out. Shankara makes a statement, as sound, it comes up, it means from not Brahman, that from the first chakra, when it comes to the third, then it takes on the element of the verb, it means the action to be performed, because that's the solar plexus, that's where action takes place. So, but then as it transforms, it turns into nouns, because verbs have to be expressed through nouns. So that means verb is the action, but it's the nouns that are actually going to perform the action. Right? Verbs don't perform action. Swimming doesn't do the swimming. You know what I'm saying? It's like that, you know what I'm saying? A noun does the verb. So then the problem comes up here is that they're saying that everything goes back to the verbs. So basically speaking, all dhatus do, but there are dhatus that don't. So it's not that rule that is absolute rule, that it has to be based on an action, right? So one school is saying that it all has to do an action, the other is saying it doesn't have to infer an action. But then the problem comes in both of them, is
the swimming Krishna is existing.
Yeah, the thing is they don't, somehow or another, aren't dealing with this transitive, you know, just because if it's, then it's not a fact, it has to be doing something. If it's doing something, then it can't be a fact. Right? So that's the one problem with there is you can't actually have facts because it must show that something's being done. Right? And the other one is it doesn't have to be doing anything. But at the same time, is if it's not doing anything, what's its purpose at all? You know, so does that make sense? So they've taken it to such an extreme in trying to appreciate it that they're not... They're missing the point that the Veda's there. There's a purpose to it. There's a conclusion that there's... So there's all these elements of there's the fact, there's the attitude, there's the activity, there's the results. But it's they're not like considering the full process, right? Because Godhead isn't really an element in this. So how are they going to get all these various aspects of how they're supposed to view things? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Is it that they're not considering consciousness? They're just considering activity and...
Because the point is you only get results from an activity, yeah. And they're only interested in results. But the thing is you should know, you know, properly who you are and what the situation you're dealing with. So that aspect they aren't so good at. You know, it means as far as performing the fruitive work and getting a result from that fruitive work, then they're quite good.
Yes.
But that's based on the premise that everything is for fruitive work.
Yes.
Right? So they can't tell the difference between dharma, sadharma, this kind of element. And therefore, that's where their weakness is. Because their definition of who they are, what the material world is, what God is, there's some weakness there. Right? But they're very fixed in doing what they do, right? You know, just like yogis do their, you know, focusing on the tip of the nose, the nyayas, then they're, you know, dealing with the logic, these kind of things. They do these very well. But the problem is they don't actually properly know who they are. You know, what's the world and what it's for. That's the weakness. So each has the thing that distracts them.
Can we summarize it as mental speculation?
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to base it on the Shastra, but the difficulty is their application of it isn't correct. Like that. Okay. Was there something else you wanted to bring out there? Or no? Mm-hmm. Statements of fact do evoke responses to their hearers. Like it was, point is you're saying is they get responses, but there's nothing to do, right? That was the point, is, you know, you have a son. So now he's very happy, but it's not like there's something to do, but it gets a response, right?
Smoke a cigar.
Mm-hmm.
Smoke a cigar.
Yeah, I guess you can infer that. Responses that inform the hearers about a conversation's meanings. And many simple declarative statements have no link to a need to do something. Persons who insist there is such a link may presume there is an unspoken injunction behind every statement of fact, but this presumption has no apparent justification. Someone might suggest that young Chaitra could originally have learned the meaning of the statement, a son has been born to you, only in connection of hearing an injunction to a father, such as, take a look at him. And so when Chaitra himself becomes a father for the first time and is told a son has just been born to you, there must be an implied action on Chaitra's part, such as, take a look at him. That is, the statement used again in the second circumstance must still imply an injunction to act. The proponents of the second view respond with several objections. First, grammatically or logically, nothing inherent in the statement, a son has been born, implies you should look at him. If Chaitra had instead been told, a big angry bull is running to you, one could easily infer that because, as a rule, big angry bulls are dangerous, Chaitra should also do something to avoid this one. But a son has been born to you doesn't necessarily imply the imperative, you should look at him. Yeah, it means, because the imperative means something's being done. So here's the declarative. I mean, what do you call it? No. Yeah, declarative. The difficulty comes is that these are all aspects of verbs. So since they're only into karma, then they argue over verbs. Yeah. Yes. Right? That's the whole thing, is that they're keeping themselves busy by, you know.
And it's funny that still they get it so wrong if they're so much into it.
Yeah. No, it's just, you know, it's like... You know, they're sitting there in an ion microscope trying to figure out the whole cosmos. You know, it's like, what to do? You know, it's just like, let us say I go down to, you know, a modern construction site and I pick up, you know, something off the site and I take it back to the lab, put it under the ion microscope. So definitely now I can understand everything about, you know, why this construction is going on and how it's unfolding and everything, because I've looked at, you know, a piece of plasterboard under my microscope. Right? It tells me all about the foundations, all about how many stories there are. It means all the different things, what people are going to be doing in all the offices, you know. It, you know, it's all...
At least in the near future, you will know.
Yeah. And if you just keep looking long enough, it will all be revealed. So that's, yeah. That's
we used to think, we now know that.
Yeah. We used to think it was just a piece of plasterboard. Now
we know. That's the source of creation.
Yes. Moreover, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself breaks the rule that all meaningful words must have at least an implied link to an enjoined action. That is to say, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself expresses what needs to be done, and it is the main word of the sentence. The subject, predicate, and modifiers are all syntactically subordinate to the verb, but the verb is independent. It refers to the action of the statement by its own power, without needing to be defined with the help of the other words. Apart from this, words in a sentence other than the verb have meaningful syntactic connections with one another. No matter how 3-year-old Chaitra learned what the words son, born, and your mean, now that Chaitra has grown up, he can easily piece together the idea of your son has been born without having to conjure up any injunction. Putting the words into Sanskrit, let's take the sentence tava putra jata, your son has been born. If Chaitra knows enough Sanskrit grammar, he will recognize putra as the subject case noun, jata as a past passive participle serving as the verb in the sentence, and tava, your, is a possessive pronoun. The verb has its subject, and the subject is possessive modifier. Thus, with no need for any injunction of an action yet undone, these three words, with their grammar and their dictionary meanings, express the complete idea, and Chaitra should be able to understand it. As a last result, for salvaging the rule that all words must link with something to be done, one might propose that imperative verbs connect with other unspoken imperatives. One could assume that the word look in "you should look at him" is connected with a previous injunction like, for the good fortune of one's newborn child, one should look at him once. But what logical reason sustains this assumption? Otherwise, then you spend your time trying to find something to link it to. But at least you could say one thing about the Karma Mimamsas, right? They'll always be busy. Right? They won't be lazy, dead like that.
That's true.
As a last resort for okay. But what logical reason sustains this assumption? The supposed injunction that one needs to look at a newborn child is not recorded in any shastra. Other attempts to manufacture previous injunctions will also result in imaginary injunctions or pairs of injunctions that don't follow logically from one another. And applying thoroughly the rule that injunctions by implication must be connected with previous injunctions would result in an infinite regress, each imperative needing support from an infinity of previous ones. So there, but then why is there a need for the auspicious good fortune of one's newborn child? You know, so then what's the, because that itself would have to be injunctions. But the point is that the pair means the one that's the one behind has to be paired up also to be valid. And that has to be paired up. So then just by one thing, there's a million things that you have to do. Does that make sense? So, because they're only following back one. But technically, logically, you'd have to, that one would have to have one in there like that. Okay. Jiva Goswami. Now that it is thus established that statements of fact have denotative power, and that a hearer whose perception of a statement is not obstructed can be seen to realize the meaning the speaker intended, right, the tatparya. It follows that texts like the Upanishads that speak of matters of fact are authoritative in their literal sense. Okay, so it appears that this was it's yeah. So then the difficulty comes up is Upanishads are in the latter part of the Veda. And this is concerning the earlier part, so the Brahmanas. So Brahmanas are saying how to use the words in ritual. But the point is they only use certain shlokas. They don't use all the verses. Right? So those are the ones that are used for Brahmanas. So they're taking it, that's all there is just the Brahmanas. But the aspect of the Aranyakas and Upanishads, right? That then is other understandings. So you have the ritualistic understanding, the metaphysical, and then the philosophical. So they're kind of like leaving the other two. So they're trying to make everything work on the one. You know, just like in devotional service, there's activity that's done with knowledge and meditation on the Lord. So if you take only karma and try to get a complete package without the other two, then you have to somehow or another to come up with some kind of funny understandings to get it to feel complete, or at least people are satisfied and keep themselves busy. Does that make sense? Right? So that's the idea, is that the actual completeness is in devotional service. So all these different words, everything has meaning, but it has its different elements that are there, right? Different aspects, just an application. But in this, ultimately, we see, because the Upanishads are the philosophical, that gives the basis for why the other things are done. And in it, it will make a lot of statements of fact. Right? Because otherwise, we find most of it is, you know, you are that, and, you know, is that makes sense? These kind of things, then those will be ignored by the Karma Mimamsas, because it doesn't tell them to do something. And in this way, then they can just stick on karma and not have to worry that there's something beyond. Yes. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or is that like reading the Nectar of Devotion and then Temple Commander saying, you come to the temple to do service, you should have done your reading before you joined the temple?
Yeah. Yeah. Even though you only came in contact with Nectar of Devotion when you came to the temple, but somehow or another, you know, just
that would be like a little bit of contamination of that kind of karma, but it's devotional service. So
no, that's just niti.
Right.
You know, you want the guy to, you know, you want him to do something. He's come up with a reason why he shouldn't be doing it, and so then you remove that obstacle. The problem is then you remove also the understanding that you should read it all, right? You know, so you know it has side effects, but yeah. This has been stated as follows. Even when mantras and their explanations are subsidiary to other statements, their own literal sense is still authoritative. It's not that it's dependent. So it means it's dependent that without the other thing it doesn't, something more. No, it's just in a secondary position, but it's still authoritative. So if from the Shabda a specific understanding arises that is not contradicted in its literal sense, that is comprehensible. And that refers to something heretofore unknown. Why is that shabda not authoritative? Even if it does not express the intention of any author. Okay. If it refers to something that you don't know about, why is that shabda not authoritative, even if it does not express the intention of any author? When the statements of scripture offer praise and criticism, when they repeat something already known from another source, when they explain the qualities of things, and when, moreover, the Upanishads, independent of any other authority, make known the truth of the self, truth devoid of everything undesirable, consistently endowed with unlimited bliss, and not already known, then even when other means of knowing are contradictory, it is the other means that are reduced to a shadow of themselves, leaving the scripture authoritative in its literal sense. Bhagavan Nama Kamudi 1:13. What is this?
Bhagavan Nama Kamudi?
Yeah. No? But he's quoting from that.
I'm not really sure.
But it seems to be something because, what do you call it? It's about the names of the Lord and stuff. Okay, that's Sarva Sambhadani 43. Like Jaimini's Mimamsakas, the followers of Vyasadeva's Vedanta philosophy accept the primal authority of the Vedas. But Vyasadeva's followers go beyond the Mimamsakas' ritualistic interpretation. The Mimamsakas deprecate as not very significant those statements of the Vedas that are mere explanations and value judgments, what the Mimamsakas called Artavada, and the attempts of the Upanishads to define an absolute truth. For Vedantists, however, the purpose of the Vedas is not only to enjoin, but also to reveal facts unknown by other means. In the view of the Vedantists, discovering the higher truth that unifies all existence is even more important than hearing how to act dutifully. Thus, because otherwise, if you don't know why you're acting, it means you should act dutifully, that's good. But the point is why should you act dutifully? What's the reason behind that? Right? Right, because otherwise, then if we're saying, okay, then everything has to be defining a duty. Okay, but why? What's the necessity of everything has to be defining a duty?
Then I'll be happy.
Yeah, it'll be something because you get a result from that duty, you'll be happy. So it's not about the absolute truth. So anything that's talking the absolute truth is something beyond. Then it's a difficulty. Right? Unless it's revealing something beyond, like, you know, the heavenly planets. But you can see the direct connection. Right? But here it's defining the absolute truth, which is beyond.
Yes.
Yeah. Thus, the first sutra of Jaimini's Mimamsaka Sutras, the Tato Dharma Jigyasa, now let us inquire into duty, is superseded by the first sutra of Vyasadeva's Vedanta Sutras, the Tato Brahma Jigyasa. Now let us inquire into the absolute truth. According to...
It seems that there are quite a few Vedanta Sutras.
Quite a few Vedanta Sutras.
Yes.
There's Vedanta Sutras means in our or in Govinda Bhashya, the organization is 555 sutras. Yeah, it's in four chapters. Four chapters, and each chapter has four sections, so 16 total. Right? So they're divided up like that. 500 means there'll be a little difference between the various schools because, depending upon which aspect they're trying to bring out, they either some sutras, some, you know, areas it becomes two sutras, or some of them two become one, or they split it differently, or things like that. They even use commas just to make sure, like that.
And Atato Brahma Jigyasa is one.
It's the first one.
The first one.
Like that. So it's the first, so that's considered like the invocation. So therefore you can say, you can also say the first one is Janmadhyasayataha.
Yes.
But it's not, it won't be 111.
Yes.
That'll be 112.
Yes.
Right? Bhagavatam, that's 111.
Yes.
But in there it'll be 112, because you'll take the opening. Just like you can say, you know, the Om Pur Namadaf, that's the invocation of the Isha Upanishad.
Yes.
So then the first verse is the one after that.
Yes.
Yeah, Ishavasya. Right, you understand? So, either way, it's looked at. It doesn't matter. with that. Does that make sense? So it's the first verse, but it's not necessarily that's the number.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, so it works either way. Because the point is you have to inquire about the Supreme, and the point is that the Supreme is the source of everything. You know? Because
it's a continuation.
Yeah, no, it's just natural. It's because it's Vedanta Sutra, so it's going to be very exact, and you can get so many things done. That's the expertise in authorship, is that so many aspects you can do. But at the same time, it's because of that principle of the opening should make it very clear. Therefore, within the first first 11 verses, depending on the chart, they've actually made all the commentaries. They'll comment on the rest, but it's all based on the commentaries in those. Does that make sense? Yeah. According to Jaimini, the Vedas include five kinds of text: mantra, injunction, definition, prohibition, and explanation. In his view, an explanation, artavad, though of no importance on its own, can supplement either an injunction or a prohibition, and it can be of three kinds. When something apparently contradictory, and therefore in need of being clarified, there is a description of a quality, gunavad. When something known from another source is being recognized, there is a restatement, anuvad. And when neither is the case, there is simply statement of fact, bhutartavad. Okay. So, in other words, for him, it's got to be something you're to do or not to do. Right?
That is the question.
Yes, that is the whole question. That's the whole, you know, and people are still, you know, thinking that Macbeth was so intellectual. Right? This is really to do or not to do, right? And then when, okay. So then the point is that it's just what you're supposed to do or to not do, because that gets in the way of what you're supposed to do. So ultimately, it's just what you're supposed to do. Then explanations are just to kind of give support there. So he won't take the explanations as that means okay. Not that the explanations aren't talking about something to do or implying that. But the point is he's making the interpretation that to do must be karma, must be fruit of work. Because if it's talking about the Supreme or about the soul, then that might imply something other than the fruitive element. Right? So therefore he's not taking those aren't considered as serious, right? Otherwise his followers might get misdirected and actually take up, you know, transcendental activity or something. Right? Wouldn't want that to happen.
No.
For example, when a doubt arises about whether the post on which an animal is sacrificed can be the same as the sun in the sky, a gunavada confirms adityo yupa. The sacrificial post is the sun. Taittiriya Brahmana 2.1.5.2 and Aitreya Brahmana 5.28.1. Or, in other words, it has the quality of representing the sun. Although a thing is already known from sense perception, as Anuvad reiterates, for example, Agnir Himasya Beishajam, fire counteracts ice, Taittiriya Samhita 7.4.18.2. And as a simple statement of fact, there is the Bhutartavad, for example, Indra Vritaya Vrajam. Udayachat. Indra raised the thunderbolt against Virat. No, Vritra. Pancha Vimsha Brahmana 13.5.22. Again, Jaimini says that these different kinds of artavad are of little meaning on their own, but merely contribute support to injunctions to perform prescribed duties. Right? Because he's just bringing everything. You can see now what he means by the hermeneutics is that everything, no matter what it is brought back to it's got to be some karma that you perform. Right? Does that make sense? So that's their whole point. So if it doesn't do that, then you don't take it seriously. Therefore, they're only going to look at those portions of the Vedas that do that. Like Brahmanas is pretty straightforward. You do this, then you put that there, and then this is picked up, and then all these different things. So it's all about what to do. right? The Aranyakas are going to be talking about the metaphysics of your different rituals and that, so that won't be taken as that important, you know. Does that make sense? You know, like this element is that, yeah, it can be like the sun or it's the sun, but the point is it doesn't really matter. The point is the yup is there, the animal goes on the yup. Right? That's the point. Does that make sense? But these other aspects are secondary for them.
Yes.
But the idea is the yup is the element with the sun. Sun is enlightening and everything like that. There should be some element of understanding going on here. You know, so what is that understanding? That they're not going to look at because they take that as secondary.
Yes.
You understand?
Yes.
So their only inquiry about why things are done is to better understand how to actually technically perform the ritual, not why is the purpose of this and why I should be doing it in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yes.
You know, in other words, it keeps them off the streets, right? They're busy. Right? And they're pious. They're not doing any nonsense. Right? You want to say something?
Yeah, in the morning, Jules was coming. I think he was using the same rule to explain Krishna's Bhagavad Gita, all the verses of Bhagavad Gita should be.
Oh, yes, Pari,
Paribhasha
Sutra. Yeah, that it's all should be seen like that. Interesting is because the interesting thing about this is that when it comes to defining philosophy like that, Mimamsa, and that, you know, in a Shastra, in other words, you read a Shastra, what's in it, how to approach it, then Jaimini's formula for that is what everybody uses. But unfortunately, even though he's the one who comes up with that formula, he doesn't actually know what to actually ultimately do with what he's understood from that Shastra. Because then within that he takes all those different verses and defines them in ways that are just supportive of karma. So already, you know, the hermeneutics has been defined in that way, but then it makes it very exact, you know, how to approach and therefore what to do and everything. Is that? Okay. Some argue that Vedic statements lack tatparya, the intention of a speaker, because the Vedas have no author. Okay. But even if this might be so, the author of the Bhagavan Nama Kamuri assures us the Vedas are capable, with or without the intention of any speaker, and in spite of any contrary evidence for perception or logic, of describing the reality of the absolute truth. Yes, yeah, so because they're not interested what's beyond the Mimamsakas. Means as far as they go, it's just I did the work. You know, God gives. Means in other words, the actions and reactions, I mean, the results of your actions is given by the Lord, is sanctioned by the Lord. But their point is, if I don't do the work, he can't sanction it, so the Lord's dependent upon me, so it's all about me. So other schools just know that he's there and he's created, so they don't even get even this far, but they don't make it that they're the center because, you know, because I'm logical, therefore, I don't know. Their point is it's logical before I started logic, or the atoms are there before I got involved. But in any case, all of them, the Supreme is not really taken as important. Like only in Shankara's interpretation of Vedanta, then you see a focus that is specifically on the Supreme, even though it's still the school is bogus, but you know, its conclusions still end up wrong. But at least there's an understanding there's something beyond. Right? Therefore, Shankara could defeat the Mimamsakas. Right? Because he had to do that to establish Vedanta. Right? Because otherwise you're going to bring all these Buddhists back into the Vedic culture and then they're all going to become Karma Mimamsakas. Right? And then the problem is that's where the problem started with in the beginning. You know? It's these karma bodies that were misapplying the Veda and, you know, killing the animals unnecessarily, right? And so, therefore, you had to start the whole Buddhism. So that would be a waste of, you know, what is it, like a few thousand years or something, if that happens. So you're going to have to defeat them so that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because at least in Vedanta, technically, it should be easier to then get the correct conclusion from the Acharyas and then understand Vaishnava Vedanta, understand the Supreme.
Yes.
Right? So at least you've gone from the Brahman platform, then you understand Bhagavan. But if you're dealing with karma, you're not even worried about Brahman. Yes. So then it's kind of like, you know, it doesn't leave the door much open. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
It seems that the intention of any head of school is very important.
Yes.
Gemini,
No, it's all means the intent. That's the point. Is that tatparya? I think Madhva uses the term very much. Tatparya. It's always. Generally, they use it in the term of tatparya linga. I think it's always. Mm. You know, what's that form? What's the intention? And what's it going to bring about?
Mm. And it means that somebody who knows the Sikh system, yeah, is able to deal with all philosophies.
All philosophies, yes. It's important. Sri Maharaj would strongly make the point, it's not that a philosopher that you bump into nowadays is going to be talking one specific school. Mm. But it's all the fundamentals that philosophy has will be from these six schools.
Yes.
Then people will put them together in their own unique way with their own twist on it. So if you understand these six, you have a better shot at understanding what kind of, you know, what they've done with it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
What type of knot they have in their mind.
Yeah, yeah. You know, just something how it's been. But the point is, you know the parts that it's dealt with. You know? That's why we make the point that those discussions with Prabhupada about the philosophers, even if they didn't properly represent a specific school, they represent elements of contemporary philosophy, and the answers to those points that are made are valuable.
Yes.
You know, so now if you want to rearrange them to match the different schools, great. Mm-hmm. Right.
And we also have these tendencies in our devotional life to kind of go a little in this direction, this and that direction. So
really? What would give you that indication?
I'm falling. Of course, all of you are Paramahamsas.
No. I'm just saying why. I mean, just because the Acharyas always talk about pure bhakti and everything else is kind of off track. Would you get the idea from there? Or
It's just speculation.
This neophyte, you know, has distracted. The mudgala is steady and so all that. The uttama is then, you know, on the, you know, the threshold of love of God. So, I mean, where are you getting these indications from?
It's a speculation, you know.
Yes, you wanted to say something?
Oh, yeah, earlier, this commentary on Mahabharata called Top Party, if you hear that.
Yes, you know. So the whole thing is what's the intention? It's a very, very important element. We generally have a tendency to put it on the side, and like these Mimamsakas argue over words, like, you know. But it's the intention that they meant by the word that's important. I remember, you know, sometime back having a discussion that had been bothering me for a long time, because the person had used these words very strongly, and so they were trying to say, well, that's not what they meant, but you use this word, so you know, that's it, like that. But it's not about the word, it's about the intention of the word. Right? Because sometimes people use the words and you know, differently than how we'd use them, or necessarily differently how then would be ideal or everything like that. But the point is the words are only to convey someone's intention. Right? And so the more standard that is, the less of a problem. Therefore, as we mentioned in logic, then it's the, what's that first book? Tarka Sangaha. Everybody accepts that because that gives definitions, and then everybody will have the same understanding of the words. Now, how you put those together and that's another thing. But at least if you say something. Right there, like he says, you know, the animal with the dewlap.
Yes.
There isn't another animal other than the cow. That's why, you know, you see the Indian cows is very prominent. The Western, it's not so much. But that's what defines them, yes.
If they accept this Dharma Sangraha, why would they argue over the words if their definitions are there?
No, but their point is, their thing is, then those words are put together in sentences, so what do those sentences mean? Right? So then if the sentence is not telling you to do something, then either it infers to do something, or it's just in support of doing something. You know, so then you go looking for something to do. At least it keeps everyone busy. Right?
Do they have an explanation of why the rest is there?
Sir?
They just call it non-eternal. I don't know. Just to give flavor, accentuate the prescribed duties.
Matato Dharma Jigasa.
But the thing is, they miss that the dharma is prescribed duties, but there's why dharma is different than artha or niti, is that dharma is connecting it to the supreme.
Yes.
Right? That was the element, you know, in Manu, that the sages are approaching Brahma. Oh, it's back up here. Elevated back to its position.
Dharma is connected with the Lord.
Yes, is that they knew Dharma, but the point is what's it, you know, what's it for? So they were approaching Brahma because he could explain it, how it connects to the Supreme Lord, for knowing the Lord. Not even just you can connect it and then leave it there, because the creation is there, you connect it back to the Lord. But why should you be doing that? Right? So that one can actually understand the absolute truth. That's the point. That's where it gets hard to understand, because for the Mimamsakas, then why do you need to know about the absolute? It's just about the activity, right? So therefore the prescribed duties, it's enough. Okay, you connect it to the Lord, nice, but why would you want to know the Lord? And then for the impersonalists, then you know, the jnanis, therefore, they'll take it that, okay, it'll teach you about the Lord, that's its use, but why would you want to use activity? Right? So therefore devotional service becomes hard to understand for both schools.
Yes.
Right? Because actually devotional service is the combination of all those things, and they're just using a part of it and trying to make it complete. So that they're trying to take it, we're standard, you know, where'd you guys come from? You know? Does that make sense? You know, it's kind of like, you know, the prisoners are sitting there and they're all in the yard and going, you know, yeah, we're here. Who are these guys in the suits? You know? No, the guys in the suits represent what's outside, you know? You know? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the problem. Okay, refutation of Svokavad. Now that we understand that all the verbal expression that constitutes the Vedas is authoritative in its literal meaning, right? Because otherwise, these are saying it's not important, the literal meaning, or it doesn't have any point. They're saying it's non-eternal. Not that it's not part of the Veda, not that it's not always there, but it doesn't refer to something eternal that should be done. It's just saying something. So that's their way. That's their way of using, you know, political correctness to make it, you know, work for them. So you just redefine the words and stuff, and then it sounds great. You know, you don't have to. Does that make sense? So that kind of thing's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
It's not new.
Right? Going on today.
Yeah, because Jaimini's 5,000 years ago, so it's not a new thing. Right? We must now explain how that expression generates its meaning. We should consider first that because individual sounds, because otherwise someone might say, well, I mean, why get into discussing the words and how it functions if the concept that certain words have meaning, value, and certain don't is there. So you have to establish, no, the Vedas, it all has meaning. It's all value.
Yes.
Okay? Then we can get down to words, right? Because they're throwing out sentences. So what does it mean discussing words until the sentence thing has been worked out? We should consider first that because individual sounds quickly cease to exist, they lack the force to generate a statement's meaning. Therefore, the opinion of some scholars is that the last sound, linked to the mental impressions created by each sound before, produces recognition of the meaning. Right? So it's all like connected. You say so many things, and then the last word connects. But that sounds kind of more like how teenagers work. Right? They just hear the last word.
Yeah,
everything before that, like, you know, take out the garbage, you know, vacuum, you know, the floor and pick up your room, you know, before dinner. Dinner! Okay, yeah, so, you know.
I want hot dogs.
Yeah, that doesn't exactly, yeah. Okay, let's see what's going on. These mental impressions are known only from their effect, since they are not accessible to censored perception. Other scholars think that because of the sequential nature of the remembrance produced by mental impressions, a whole statement is not simultaneously perceived, and so not even the final sound can make the meaning known. They propose that what makes it known is svota, a kind of special potency. Quote, and since the individual sounds, being many, cannot be perceived altogether, the seeds of impression are planted in a person by his perception of each sound, one after another. And with the last sound, his awareness matures, suddenly bestowing the recognition that the statement is the object of a single perception. Sharirka Bhashya Shankya 1328. So this is from Sarvasambandhani 44. So interesting is that you understand, because you're hearing all these different words, and at some point, then you have to put them together. So the thing is while you're hearing each word, it's not actually the understandings there. So some say is when it gets to the last one, then hearing that, then you can put the whole thing together.
It seems like what happens to us now.
Yeah, as we get to the later ones, it starts to make some sense. But here's the other, the Svotavadis, they say, no, each word has this special potency, that this potency is there, then the next potency, next one, when you hear the last word, that potency is the link for the whole thing. Right? So it's basically saying the same thing. It's just saying that there's this unknown potency there, a kind of special potency. But they're not attributing that to the Lord, you know, like that. They're just, you know, Jiva Goswami does.
So what is that shakti called? What is that shakti called?
Here it's called svota.
That's the actual shakti.
Svota means something?
No.
Does not mean just the word itself means something? It just means a special potency.
Like a flash.
A flash. Okay. Instead, so it's just, in other words, they're trying to work out why is it that you can, cognition is there of words. Because words are what's used, so how do you work it all out?
Isn't it that usually in Sanskrit you have the verb in the end?
Generally.
I mean, and then it just seems like it's pretty made up. I mean, that would mean that the sentence would only make sense when the verb comes.
Yeah, but the other sets the context, because the point is an activity has to take place in a context.
And so they make a whole philosophy out of that?
That's what all philosophies are. They take one thing and make a philosophy out of it. I don't remember who he was, but he's one of the main famous contemporary philosophers. Back, I don't know, 1700s, 1800s. He was very intelligent, but he was a total debauchee. I mean, just like, you know, scumbag debauchee, kind of, you know. But somebody pointed this out to him, and he became so insulted by it that he created a whole philosophy to explain it, and it's one of the major philosophies of today, like that, you know. Now that's the power of, you know, French cafes, yes. You know, like that. It's like you can sit there and come up with all this.
Sartre is kind of in that category. Sartre? Isn't he kind of in that category?
He might have been the guy. But it's one of those who is very degraded. Because most of the other ones, they kind of have their lifestyle and, you know, they're, you know, intellectually a little weird, but, you know, like this. But he is just, morally, he was very, very...
He was living in brothels and stuff like that.
Yeah, so it may have been him. So he's kind of, like, this is, so they, that's just the way the material world is. You have some material desire, you make up a philosophy.
Philosophy.
Yeah. Yes.
I heard
a smile. Okay. Traditional Sanskrit scholars have been investigating the nature of the language for at least 2,000 years. They have proposed various theories to explain how sounds, words, and sentences express meaning. These studies begin with the theory of Sanskrit grammar, especially as formulated by Panini. Panini explained the entire language in both its Vedic and epic dialects in a precise, complex system of a few thousand sutras. He assumed, however, that sentences are nothing more than combinations of words, just as words are conventional combinations of sounds, and thus he focused his analysis on how individual words are formed. The difficult question of, right, because he's taking it that, you know, sentences are there, they explain things, so those are made of words. And the point is, words are made of these various sounds. So the important thing is that it's you have to put these sounds together to make the words. So the grammar is how to put those words together, and then how to put the words into the sentences. Right? The difficult question of just how words combine their meanings to yield the complete idea of sentences was addressed only by later thinkers, notably the philosophical grammarians of the school founded by Bhartrihari in the 5th century. Bhartrihari criticized as naive the notion that one grasps the meaning of a word simply by recognizing, one after another, the phonemes that compose it, and that one grasps the meaning of a sentence simply by adding up the meanings of the words. He proposed and said that a word possesses a special potency, shabda svota, that expresses the word's meaning. So Bhartrihari is the father of the svota line.
Well, no, this is different than the previous svota, but he's condensing the special meaning down to just a single word, not the whole thing.
The whole thing
then
meaning?
Then the last word that ties everything together.
So, what does he say?
That each word itself individually has a special potency.
But didn't that say, here's that it goes along, and since the individual sounds being many cannot be preserved altogether, the seeds of impression are planted in a person by this perception of each sound one after another. And with the last sound, his awareness matures, suddenly bestowing the recognition that the statement is the object of a single perception. There's not a connection there, or there's some... What's the difference?
It seems that Bhartrihari, he's trying to defeat that previous statement. And then I think it's just rather than this kind of potency that pervades all the words and then the final one has like the missing link to hold them all together, he seems to be saying that each individual word...
Oh, I see. So he's leaving out the final word as the one that holds it together.
That's what it appears like. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that a special potency that expresses the word's meaning, a potency not found in the individual phonemes of the word. He similarly... how do you say that one?
Posited.
With another potency, that another potency in a sentence, vakya svota, expresses the meaning of the sentences, separate from the meaning of its individual words. Therefore, say the followers of Bhartrihari, the Vedas are eternal because they take the form of svota. Indeed, the quote, indeed, the repeated utterance is an act of collection. Recollection, excuse me. The proponents of Vedanta philosophy, however, follow this principle. The phonemes themselves are the verbal expression, according to Bhagavan Upavarsha, Sharig Bhashya of Shankya 1328. The Vedantists thus acknowledge that words, simply as composed of phonemes, are eternal, since everyone realizes the sameness of the sounds referred to when one says the word go has been pronounced twice rather than two words go have been pronounced. What does that mean?
I think he's taking rather than from the sentence having meaning to the word having meaning. Each individual phoneme itself is possessed of a special potency.
Okay. These phonemes, moreover, become bound like ants in a row to particular meanings, endowed with sequence and other features. And when they are employed in being spoken, the perception of one phoneme after another is followed by an awareness in which the phonemes are remembered, and they invariably make known the various meanings of the statements. Thus, those who propose the phoneme theory have less to presume than the proponents of T. What is T?
I'm sorry.
It. It.
Svote. Proponents of T. What is T?
Less than Ach.
Less than Ach, yes. Even more. Who abandon what is apparent and presume what is not. The Vedantists are of the opinion that to say that these phonemes perceived in a sequence reveal the svota, and that the svota reveal the meaning, is a heavier presumption.
Mars, it doesn't seem to make sense that it would be every word, because sometimes if you miss the beginning of a statement, but you hear the end of it, and then you can like anuman the beginning, and oh, that doesn't make sense. So it wouldn't make sense that it was every word has potency. That would be logical.
Could be, false. But then you, yeah, at the same time as then you have the opposite, with, like with Sanatana Goswami. Mm-hmm. Means how he became the minister, the prime minister. You remember that? No one else? Just three, okay. Four. Half.
Yeah.
Means the architect had made this tower, this minaret, and they were up looking at it. And then, somehow or another, I'm not sure what happened, but the architect or something said something he shouldn't have and insulted the Nawab. So he pushed him out of the tower, right? And minarets tend to be a bit tall, right? So that was, you know, how you say, it was not good for his health. Put it that way, you know. So then the Nawab turned to, you know, one of the, you know, attendants there and said, go to, and he mentioned this village. And he was so worried, you know, to just get done what he should get, otherwise he gets thrown out also, that after hearing that, he just ran off and went to that village. It must have been Ramakali. So then Sanatan happened to be walking, you know, there in the village and saw this man looking very, very disturbed and just walking back and forth in the middle of the village. He came up to him and said, what's the problem? And then he related, you know, that, you know, the Nawab said, go to Ramakali, you know, and said, yeah, and for, he says, I don't know, that's all I heard. So he said, okay, well, what was the situation? He said, why did he say that? And then he told him the whole thing. Then he could understand, well, Ramakali is famous for its architects and builders and all that. So he wants you to bring another one. So he went, took him to where they were, you know, introduced, and then the guy took back with him, and he came to the Nawab, and the Nawab, you know, was, you know, very happy and all that. And then it's kind of like, wait a minute. You only heard the first half. You didn't hear the other half. You're not smart enough to work. Who worked this out? And so then he says, you know, therefore, okay. So it also works. Yeah. And basically you could also say is you have the other element that probably, you know, the bulk of your undergraduates, you know, pass exams because they read every third word, right, you know, and like that. And so this way they get, you know, they give you 20 books to read in one term, which is like basically an impossibility. So, you know, you could get through five or six, so that's every third word, and, you know, works it out. So, yeah. Anyone who uses words knows that we understand them by recognizing their phonemes one after another. The Svotavadis, however, deny this obvious fact and place it with a concept that represents nothing in ordinary experience. The Svotavadis presume further that what is eternal in the Vedas is not the individual letters and words, but the overall meaning. This eternal meaning, they say, is recollected every time the Vedas are recited. The Vedantists, however, accept that not only the meaning, but also the phonemes and the words of the Vedas eternally exist. So does that mean is what Shankara is saying is then representing the Vedantic school of explanation?
No, my understanding is that he's the Veda, the Sharira of Bhashya, is describing the Svotavad, whereas it's the Vaishnavas that hold this phoneme theory. That we consider all the phonemes themselves to have the meaning inherent within.
So he's only discussing that. But he's not. What is his statement? Because he says the Vedantists. He's not even making a differentiation here.
Vedantists reverse the Vaishnavas in this context, it seems.
Okay. And you were saying?
Maybe Shankara was just quoting this part of the idea.
Oh, just that part was just from there. But he makes a statement, or?
My understanding is that all Vedantists, they subscribe to the Varnavad, which is the opposite Svotavad.
Varna?
Varnavad
means the Varnas. Okay, so they're saying the Svota is that there's some special potency in them.
Yeah, I think the Sharika of Bhashya here is just quoting, like he's saying the Svotavadis. It wasn't actually Shankara's position. Svotavada was not Shankara's position. The phoneme theory is the position shared by all Vedantists, including the Mayavadis and the...
Okay, so depending upon what point you're taking, then there's even a point where Prabhupada's talking about the greatness of India because of the culture, you know, coming from the Vedas. And he's even quoting his great personalities, you know, that are influential in people, that Vivekananda and Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Right? But then as he brings it, you know, then when that's India and the rest of the world. Then within India, then you have what's sampradayic and what's not. Mm-hmm. Right? So therefore then all these others go out. Right? But then, you know, Shankara is still left. Right? Does that make sense? And then you have like that. Then we'll take it up. Then it's the those who, you know, Vaishnava Vedanta. And then of that, then, you know, Achinta Veda Veda Tattva. So depending upon how, so it's a common point. It's that they're making a correct point, then it's a correct point. Like that. So Varnavadis. We're Varnavadis. Okay.
Karma Mimamsa, they defeat all the previous ones because they comment on each and every sloka. But if they don't accept that all the phonemes and words they have are meaning, on what basis they comment on each and every one?
I guess in relationship, I mean, it seems from what we were discussing, from relationship to what duties you're supposed to perform. Does that make sense? So in other words, they interpret everything to be involved with how you're going to, what prescribed duty you perform to maintain your piety. Because the idea is that if you maintain piety, then you will eternally be happy. If you're always pious, you'll always be getting the results of previous pious activities. So you'll always be happy. So that way you can eternally be happy in the material world. Problem is Krishna, who made the place, said every action is covered by fault. So that means, along with getting your pious, there's going to be something that gets kind of in the way. Right? Because let's say Yayati. Now Yayati, what he performed in austerities is very great. It got him to the point, you know, he could go up and visit higher places than just Indra's place. Indra would come and personally talk with him. You don't hear that Indra just comes and hangs out with anybody. Like that. But the problem is that doing those austerities generated pride. So when Indra said, do you feel that there's anybody else more pious than yourself? Right, you know, you naturally should say, of course, because there's all the great persons, you know, Brahma, the Prajapatis, you know, Brihaspati, and of course, because you're talking to Indra, yourself, you know, 100 yajnas, you know, like this and that. So many great personalities. And we're just, we've done what we could, and, you know, we're here. And then he would have been fine, right? But he didn't. No one else has done what I've done, this and that. And Indra's kind of looking at it and says, I'm Indra, you're not. You know, kind of like that. Plus, you have the thing of insulting everybody else, you know, like that. And so then he just, you know, tossed them out of heaven. So that's the fault, and he performed his pious activities, got those results, but there was a fault along with it that then therefore something goes wrong. But at the same time, as other than that one thing, he is accepted as a greatly, immensely pious person. So that's the only fault. So you don't write everything else off. But does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
It seems there's a problem with the Karma Mimamsas. I mean, if they, one thing is they comment on all the verses, but if half of their comments are never mind.
Yeah.
And isn't that pretty much the same as not commenting or just throwing them out?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just checking.
But, you know, at least there's the... Yeah. It's just... You know, it's kind of like... which is better, the rotten potato or the rotten apple?
This is a tough one. They're both bad.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, it's each one has their special, unique bogusness, you know.
You can make alcohol from both of them.
True. Maybe that's why the Irish got ahead, right? You know? Well, everybody else was throwing things out. They were doing something.
Hard at work.
You know, the work. But the world hands you a rotten potato.
You make schnapps.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, word meanings. And so it is acknowledged that the words of the Vedas, as made of phonemes, are eternal and express meaning. In this regard, there are three kinds of word meanings: primary, figurative, and qualitative. Primary meaning also has two divisions, conventional and derivational. Conventional meaning is an arbitrarily fixed relation between name and named, in which an object capable of being referred to is assigned a name that represents either the object's unique identity, a category to which it belongs, or a quality it has. Right? So that's how many times the word has both its specific, a unique identity, and to a category. Like we mentioned, Jyotish. Mm-hmm. It's a category, and it's also uniqueness. Yeah. Or a quality it has. Examples are the words Bitta, a person's name, cow, and white, respectively. Right, so therefore, Ditta is the person's name, the general category is cow, and the quality it has is white. So if you named a white cow Ditta,
that would be
then you
very
get all three. Yes, okay. Sarvasambandhini, 46. These varieties of word meanings have been explained by writers on the theory of poetry, Alankar Shastra. Figuratively, meaning has some connection with the meaning assigned by conventional usage, as in the example, a cowherd village on the Ganga. Figurative meaning is also three kinds: that which does not give up its own meaning, that which does give it up, and that which does both does and does not. Examples of these respectively are: the white is running, there is a cowherd village on the Ganga, and this is Devadatta. Okay, which does not give up its meaning, that's what gives up. It gives up its own meaning. The white is running. So it means the white is giving up its meaning of just being a color or something.
No, it doesn't give up its meaning.
It doesn't.
It stands for something different than the quality it represents. It's talking about like the white horse.
Okay.
Running. But simply by saying white, it still maintains the whiteness of the color, but it's not the white color that's running.
Okay.
It's a figurative. It represents the
okay.
That is white.
Okay. Okay. And then there's a cowherd village on the Ganga.
So in this sense, on the Ganga doesn't actually have meaning on the Ganga.
Okay, it just means on the bank.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is that Devadatta.
It is preserved. There's no change.
There's no change.
I don't know what it's
But but it's this is that, because it's representing, yeah. Because you've heard of them like this, and now you're meeting, so this is that one.
Yeah.
Right, so this is different than you are that, right? This is that.
Yeah.
Some authorities, including Sri Ramanuja, do not accept the last of these, but that may be studied in other books. Oh, it may be studied in their books. Their argument in brief, in this is that Devadatta, the word that indicates what was experienced before, and this describes what is being experienced now. Since nothing here stops these two words from being connected in a sentence, why does there have to be a figurative usage? It doesn't have to be. But we're just talking about if there was something you had about, you know, I would take. Does that make sense? Yeah, so it's just... Sarvasambhadini 47. In the phrase, oh, it's going to be explained here. Yeah. The white is running, sweta, is originally an adjective, but is figuratively used as a noun meaning white horse. Modern readers who might not refer to a white horse that way could think of an example from chess. White played a good game.
Now it makes perfect sense.
Okay. Because the idea of white is not abandoned. This lakshana is ajahat svarta, in which the word does not give up its own meaning. The phrase, there's a cowherd village on the Ganga, is an example of jahat svarta, in which the original meaning of a word is abandoned. A village cannot actually stand in the river. Thus, the word Ganga must refer to something else. In this case, the shore of the river. In this is that Devadatta, there are two pronouns, saha, that one seen before, and I am, this one seen now. Actually, the reference is to Devadatta's being seen now. And thus, saha abandons its literal meaning, but I am does not. And so we have an example of jahad ajahat swarta, means giving up and not giving up. What could also be is that, you know, you knew him as a little kid, and now you're seeing him as an adult, so you're saying this one is that one, like that. So in other words, you're giving up the little oneness, so now you're accepting the big oneness. In qualitative usage, one refers to something that possesses a quality of what is literally denoted and is similar to it. For example, Devadatta is a lion. As it is said, usage not unconnected with the literal meaning is called lakshana, figurative. And usage by connection with qualities figuratively referred to is called gauni, qualitative. Tantra, Vartika, 1.4.22. Figurative usage, more specifically, is based on either conventional or special purpose. An example for the first is Kalinga is reckless. And for the second, there is a cowherd village on the Ganga. In the second case, the special purpose is to make known the coolness and sanctity of the shore. Qualitative usage, however, is based only on special purpose. The Bahika man is a bull. For example, has the special purpose of making known the person's great ignorance and so on. In these three kinds of usage, primary, figurative, and qualitative, word meanings are established through derivation by combination of the meanings of the word bases and their inflections. Examples are found in the words pankaja, upagava, and pachaka. Sarvasambhadini 48-49. Okay. So... okay. Kalinga is the name of a kingdom. But by a figurative extension, the names of kingdoms can also refer to their rulers. Because like you're saying, Kalinga is reckless. You're saying that nation is reckless. Right? But it's not that, you know, it moves around and the border moves and knocks your house over or stuff like that. Or, you wake up in the morning and, it's up to you. Sitting there in Vancouver and finds it, Florida somehow or another in his backyard or something.
Would be nice.
Yeah, it might be better, right? You know, like that. Then the problem is the crocodiles.
Oh,
yeah, that's sort of like that.
True. And the old people.
Yeah. And then it might be too hot for the wheat up in Montana or something.
Also true.
And then you have a problem with the potatoes in Idaho. Okay. As described earlier, the primary meanings of words can be established either by derivation or convention. Figurative and qualitative usage are based on primary meaning, and therefore figurative and qualitative meanings can be established in the same two ways. Here, three examples of derived words are given. Pankaja means lotus, because a lotus is born, ja, from mud, pankaj. The proper name, upagava, is derived when a special suffix is added to the name of a father whose name is upagava, alpagava. Panchika, one who cooks, pachaka, okay, is formed from the word pach, to cook, by adding of the suffix that indicates the performer of an action. So then that was giving... Oh, okay, so that's the same... Okay. Primary, figurative, and qualitative. So primary is... The lotus is born from the mud. Then your figurative is... Alpagava means that he is... the son of his father, Upagava. And Pachaka means it just shows his quality. So that's what you're doing? Okay. Okay, so thank you.
Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki
Jai
Jai Nitai Gaurī means that we know what not to do. We know where something's gone wrong so we don't make the mistakes ourselves. Right? In other words, we learn that it's the intent that somebody means that's the important element. You know? And that, you know, the words used, then they have their meaning because they're given their potency by the Lord. So.
There's also like kind of quarterizing the many branches of intelligence.
Rather than
strange.